In the morning, Larry strapped heavy plates over Tim's chest, back, legs, and arms. A gorget went around his neck, beneath the high-crested helmet called a Marion. "This is my light summer suit," Tim quipped. Normally, he wore metal gloves and plates over his feet and ankles. Even without them, his outfit weighed 60 pounds.
Welcome to Book Tour. I am Netta Ulaby. Author Tony Horwitz decided to write A Voyage Long and Strange when he realized he knew almost nothing about the first Europeans to arrive in America. They're the people, as he puts it, between Columbus and the Pilgrims. Tony Horwitz traveled throughout the Americas researching this book, nothing new for a reporter who'd covered the Persian Gulf and Northern Ireland. Earlier books had Horwitz tracing the path of Captain Cook and hitchhiking in the Australian outback. Horwitz has said he enjoys writing about places extreme and uncomfortable. And he's riveted by history, how, he once said, the past leaches into the present, and how we're still haunted by events that occurred centuries ago. This recording of A Voyage Long and Strange, Rediscovering the New World, was recorded in May 2008 at the Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C. Horwitz is a frequent visitor to Politics and Prose, and the night before, he had blogged about the bookstore.
While I did make light fun of Politics and Prose in the audience here, I made a much crueler fun of where I read last night, which was the Harvard bookstore in Cambridge. I have to say, though, I did have the pleasure in speaking at Harvard about this book of giving them a pop quiz. I had this room full of professors, and I couldn't resist giving them a pop quiz about early American history based on my research. And I was sort of perversely gratified that they failed as a group. One, because it gave me a little revenge on all the teachers who had inflicted pop quizzes on me many decades ago, but also because it confirmed what was sort of the working thesis of my book, which is that Americans, even overeducated Americans at Harvard, really don't know anything about this entire era of American history. This was brought home to me rather vividly and personally when I visited Plymouth Rock about 5 years ago, having never been to see this great icon of American history. I was startled, first of all, to see how physically unimpressive it is. You may have been there. It's this sort of pathetic, cracked little boulder in a dirty sandpit. But what really struck me was a conversation I had with a ranger there about visitors. And I'll just read a couple of paragraphs of that from the prologue. Claire Olson was a veteran park ranger at Plymouth, accustomed to hearing tourists abuse the sacred stone. "A lot of people come here expecting the Rock of Gibraltar," she said. "Maybe that's where they went on their last vacation." She was also accustomed to fielding odd questions. The most common concern, the date etched into the rock's surface. Why did it say 1620, visitors wondered, rather than 1492? Or they ask, "Is this where the three ships landed?" Claire said. "They mean the Nina, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria. People think Columbus sailed here, dropped off the Pilgrims, and sailed home." Claire had to patiently explain that Columbus's landing and the Pilgrims' arrival occurred 1,000 miles and 128 years apart. Americans learn about 1492 and 1620 as kids, and that's all they remember as adults, she said. The rest of the story is blank. As she returned to counting tourists, I returned to my car, chuckling over visitors' questions. But Claire's parting comment gave me pause. Back on the road, I scanned the data stored in my own brain about America's founding by Europeans. In 1492, Columbus sailed the Ocean Blue, John Smith in Jamestown, the Mayflower Compact. Of the Indians who met the English, I of course knew Pocahontas, Squanto, and Hiawatha. That was really the sum of what I was able to dredge up. And this surprised me, first of all, because I think of myself as someone who's been an American history nerd since early childhood. My parents and my brother are here tonight, and they can attest that as a boy, my favorite bedtime reading was the Encyclopedia, and I would line up my little plastic presidents by my bed at night in order. You know, here I was in midlife realizing that, you know, there was more than a century of American history that I couldn't come up with anything. And the more I thought about it, the stranger it seemed that really we as Americans have forgotten this era. We often express reverence for our country, not just common ideals, but the land itself. And we've made a virtual fetish of the founding fathers. Yet we're strangely not very curious or well-informed about the founding that preceded that by Europeans several centuries before. What happened when the old world collided with the new many centuries ago? And why have we forgotten this period that really explains a great deal about what America became and who we are? And that, in a nutshell, was really what set me off on the long, strange voyage that became this book. And I began it by losing myself in the archives. And the first thing I really discovered was that the true story of America's founding by Europeans is much richer than the storybook version that at least I learned about solemn pilgrims in funny hats. Most of the history in this book is taken from the accounts of the explorers and settlers themselves. And what I love about these accounts is that they describe an experience we simply can't have today, no matter how far we travel, which is first contact with an entirely unknown land and people. What happens when cultures that have never encountered each other meet on a beach in Virginia or Massachusetts or in the desert of New Mexico? How do they communicate, get along, make sense of what they're seeing and hearing? It's really a fascinating study in human character and behavior, and no two stories are exactly alike. I should add that no two national groups or tribes are alike either. I have to confess, I think my personal favorites from this period are the French, who often learn native languages and are generally sympathetic observers of native culture, unlike often the English and Spanish. They also conform to national stereotype, even 400 or 500 years ago. They're always writing about the food, the potential for making wine, the beauty of native women. At their first colony on this continent in Florida, the first thing they do is build a bakery, because after all, it's the birthright of every Frenchman to wake up every morning to a fresh baguette. And, you know, it really makes for wonderful reading. In fact, later in this period, while the English are near here at Jamestown, starving in bountiful Virginia, they describe the fish virtually jumping out of the river into their pans, but still they're starving. The French are up in frigid Canada and northern New England, doing pretty well for themselves. Samuel de Champlain even founds one winter the first gastronomic society in America. He calls it the Order of Good Cheer, and he and his men take turns going out and gathering wild herbs and garlic and hunting wild game and cooking the best feast they can. But it's really, I think, the Spanish who are most unfairly neglected from this era. They're really the European pioneers of the U.S. continent. I know before I began this, I associated conquistadors with Cortez in Mexico and Pizarro in Peru. I had no idea that conquistadors swept across roughly half of today's U.S. continent, not just the fringes of Florida and the Southwest. They crossed the Appalachians, they rafted the Mississippi, they descended the Grand Canyon, and they rode all the way through the plains to central Kansas, much to the surprise of Plains Indians who had never seen horses before, another great instance of first contact, this time between man and creature. I tell the story in the book of the kind of best known and most significant of these expeditions by De Soto and Coronado, that are names you may be familiar with. But I also tell about some lesser known ones that I think really run counter to our stock image of Spanish conquest as a story of sort of relentless barbarity. And one in particular I like is about a man named Cabeza de Vaca, who was part of a Spanish expedition to Florida in the 1520s that goes terribly wrong from the start. They're badly led, the Indians are hostile, and they end up fleeing on crude rafts into the Gulf of Mexico and floating west, no idea where they're going, until they're hit by a hurricane off of present-day New Orleans, somewhat familiar. And those that aren't drowned are flung ashore naked and helpless and taken in by coastal Indians. And in the end, Cabeza de Vaca and a few others are the only ones that survive. And they do so by becoming faith healers to the Indians. They mix a bit of Catholic theater with what they've seen of native healing rituals. And they end up wandering the interior, being passed from tribe to tribe as celebrated medicine men. And they wander all the way west, naked, often living on the juice of a plant called the prickly pear, which I sampled while reporting this book, and it's very prickly. And they reach all the way to the Gulf of California before going south into Mexico, at which point the first Spaniards who encounter them don't even recognize them as countrymen because they've gone so native. Cabeza de Vaca writes an incredibly vivid and stirring account of this journey, which to me is one of the great adventure and survival stories of all times. It's really the first great American road trip. Yet I think it's fair to say that few Americans know that these four men, including a black slave named Estevanico, crossed the continent 260 years before Lewis and Clark under much more dramatic and trying circumstances. I think in the end, what I hope to do by telling these and many, many other such stories is to expand what we think of as American history and how we think about it. First, chronologically, by really pushing the start date back. And I'm talking here only about the European history of this continent, because obviously the native history stretches back 12,000 years or more, and they keep pushing that back with each new discovery. I begin my travels by following the Vikings, who arrive 1,000 years ago. But at the least, we need to include this long period preceding the pilgrims, really between 1492 and 1620, when a great deal is happening. But most of all, I think we need to expand this history culturally. I wrote this book against the backdrop of, or really the background noise of the immigration debate, driving around the country, listening on talk radio as people were going on about the great threat that immigration poses to our identity. And I couldn't help but be struck by the dissonance between that and the history I was following, which tells of the Spanish, but also of French, Portuguese, North Africans, and others who are roaming and also settling this continent long before the first English arrived. We're not an Anglo nation now, but we weren't at the start either. And if you think about it, if you were somehow able to beam back to 1600, when not a single English colonist occupied this continent, you would have said it was unlikely, even impossible, that we would be here today speaking English and that I would be living in a place called New England. Putting the history aside for the moment, I also travel in the wake of these explorers. That's sort of the other track of this book. I like to go to the places where history happened, one, to gauge how the past still bleeds into the present and explains why we're here today and who we are, but also because I think sometimes it can deepen your understanding of history and help you fill in the gaps in what's often a very sketchy documentary record. One example of that, I went to a ruined pueblo near Zuni, New Mexico, which was the site of the first pitched battle between the Spanish and natives in the Southwest. And we have the Spanish accounts of this, but when you go there, as I did with an archaeologist who showed me the horseshoes and large caliber bullets they found there, you get some sense of what was essentially a shock and awe campaign that the Spanish waged on Indians and enabled them to defeat much larger forces. If you think about it, for Indians who had never seen armored men on horses or heard guns before, how terrifying this would, you know, must have been, and explains to me part of the reason why, again, these Spanish armies succeeded in the way they did. At times, I take it a little further and engage in what you might call participatory history. I try and inhabit the past, canoeing down the Mississippi as the Spanish did, and a few other misadventures. And I thought I'd just close on a light note by reading a little bit from my time as a conquistador reenactor. For a previous book, Confederates in the Attic, I'd done some Civil War reenacting, but I was a little startled to learn there are people who put on 16th century Spanish armor to reenact the exploits of Hernando de Soto and other conquistadors. And I contacted one of these groups, and they invited me to join a couple of their members at a history fest in Florida. This was a particular type of reenactment. It was called a timeline event, which means that every era is represented other than the present. So you had Confederates and conquistadors and Seminoles and pioneers and even Paleolithic men all sort of milling around at the same event, and then the public coming in to see them. So I'm just going to read a little bit about my first day at this reenactment. And the two characters I referred to, Larry and Tim, were my compadres, the two who invited me to join them. In the morning, Larry strapped heavy plates over Tim's chest, back, legs, and arms. A gorget went around his neck, beneath the high-crested helmet called a morion. "This is my light summer suit," Tim quipped. Normally, he wore metal gloves and plates over his feet and ankles. Even without them, his outfit weighed 60 pounds. Larry's attire was much lighter, but just as eye-catching. Green wool jacket with braided buttons, green striped breeches, a green floppy hat, and knee-high black boots. He looked like a giant leprechaun. Larry's outfit, like Tim's, had been painstakingly researched and was modeled on the flashy camp attire of 16th century Spaniards. Tim flung a filthy white sack at my feet. "Your uniform, Don Antonio." Reaching inside, I extracted a pair of baggy woolen breeches that reached only to my knees. Next, I pulled out a ruffled muslin blouse that looked like a nightgown. At the bottom of the bag lay a pair of leather buskins. Donning the blouse, knee pants, and slippers, I confessed to Tim that I'd anticipated a rather manlier ensemble. "Not done yet," he said, handed me a quilted wool doublet, just the thing for a hot autumn day in Florida. "And now your cota de mayas." Tim had crafted the chainmail from flattened, interlocked rings of heavy wire. As he hoisted the mesh shirt, allowing me to slide in my head and arms, I felt as though I were climbing inside a chain-link fence. The mail weighed over 30 pounds, and that was before Tim strapped on a belt, scabbard, and sword. On my head, he planted a visored helmet with flaps that covered my neck and ears. All told, I was wearing 50 pounds of steel. Staggering a few feet, I knocked over a camp table and slumped awkwardly onto a tree stump. The chainmail bunched over my belt, giving me a gothic German beer belly. "What now?" I asked. The words echoed inside the cavern of my helmet. "Take it slow and drink lots of water," Tim said, "and resist the urge to use your sword on people who ask stupid questions." A few minutes later, the crowds arrived, clad in the costume of 21st century Floridians, shorts, flip-flops, and T-shirts. They meandered from camp to camp like window shoppers at the Mall of Time, snapping pictures of Indians weaving palm leaves or pioneer women scouring pots. By comparison, our camp offered little drama, two steel-clad figures standing in the sun and a leprechaun polishing armor. "What period is this?" a woman asked, consulting her timeline brochure.
16th century Spanish, I muttered through my visor.
"Oh, looks miserable." She moved on to the Seminole camp. Then a man stopped to study my chainmail. "If you look inside a toaster," he said, "you'll see metal bits that look just like what you're wearing." Others were less inventive. "That your shark suit? Need some oil? Hot?" As Tim had warned, I felt like running them through with my sword. Instead, I offered samples of the hardtack biscuits Larry had put on display. Earlier in the day, I'd tried one and almost chipped a tooth. Larry showed me the recipe, flour, water, and salt, baked until golden brown and rock hard, then left to cool in the oven, a process similar to case hardening and blacksmithing. By mid-morning, I was drenched in sweat. In theory, chainmail offered ventilation, but the heavy doublet I wore underneath trapped the heat and moisture. Tim's plate armor allowed air in the sides and seemed to command respect. So at midday, I asked whether we could swap outfits. "Be my guest," he said. The plate armor not only weighed more than chainmail,
It poked into my kidneys, collarbones, and groin. The gorget was unbearable, an iron collar, and the armor was even hotter than mail. After 10 minutes in the midday sun, the plate on my chest felt like the hood of a parked car on the 4th of July. The Spanish didn't really wear this, I moaned. They couldn't have. In answer, Tim hurled a piece of hardtack at my chest. The biscuit crumbled on impact. Then he gave me a sharp blow with the butt of his musket. I was conscious of having been struck, but only just, as when someone taps your car bumper in traffic. Tim explained that chainmail was effective at blunting sword slashes, but it didn't offer defense against the fire-hardened arrows of Florida Indians. DeSoto's men, however, didn't just fight, they marched, typically 15 miles a day, across the entire South. When I took a sample stroll around the park with Tim, I lurched and creaked like the Tin Man. My sword, protruding tail-like behind me, kept catching on bushes and the wide skirts of pioneer women. As we approached a narrow bridge over a pond, Tim took firm grip of my arm. If you fall in, you'll go down like a sinker, he said. Clunking back to camp, with passers-by affording me a wide berth, I sensed that Americans' neglect of conquistadors was partly due to their attire. Unlike others represented at the History Fest, knights in armor seemed utterly misplaced on the U.S. continent. They belonged in the Crusades or in a Monty Python movie, not tramping through the woods and swamps of Florida. Thanks for listening.
Yeah.
One question I have is, did you ever get an answer to the question why this century has been so ignored, mm-hmm. and did you ever encounter in your research anybody that has done a full-length scholarly mm-hmm. dissertation
right.
on that dark century?
I'd love to tell you that to find this history, I had to dig through the archives in Seville or London and unearth these, you know, musty unknown documents. But a lot of this history is really hiding in plain sight, which makes it all the more astonishing that we've neglected it. And scholars have certainly treated it before. I would say the most comprehensive and best known would be by Samuel Eliot Morison, mm-hmm. who wrote a two-volume work called The European Discovery of America, and he divides it into northern and southern voyages, and he covers all of this. That was written, I think, in the 1940s. As to why, despite that, we've generally ignored it, the short answer would be that I think this is an instance where the old saying, winners write the history, is true. That really, first it was in the colonial period, it was the English who triumphed in the contest for this continent. And then when the U.S. was created, it was Anglo-Americans and Protestant New Englanders in particular who really cast back and created this origin myth of Plymouth that exalted their own forebearers and ignored the wicked Catholics and the Spanish and the French and even Southerners. I mean, after all, Jamestown precedes Plymouth by 13 years, but they even kind of successfully pushed that to the background, and the Civil War increases that tendency. So I think there are a lot of reasons, but I would say that's the short answer.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I went to Plymouth Plantation mm-hmm. last year, the year before last, I don't remember. And there seemed to be, as I remember it, one room where they were debunking the whole Thanksgiving mm-hmm. Plymouth
yeah.
and the Pilgrim thing. And I remember that, you know, they didn't dress like that, and mm-hmm. all of that was wrong. And then I remember one book over to the left-hand side, which was The Diary of William Bradford.
Mm-hmm.
And the only mention in there about Thanksgiving was a little footnote. So is there other mentions someplace right. else in history besides that footnote? I was thinking it was just this footnote. We're celebrating this yeah. footnote.
Well, I mean, this is, I talk about it in the book because it's a wonderful story. I mean, I'm also fascinated how these myths get made. And briefly, there are only two mentions. Yeah, William Bradford's journal and one other book that he appears to have co-authored with another settler. Together, it might be five or six sentences. They don't call it a Thanksgiving, which to them was a very solemn religious observance. They don't mention turkey, and certainly not pumpkin pie, all the trimmings. They didn't invite the Indians. The Indians just showed up. And that's really all we have to go on. And again, the short version is in the 19th century, this was sort of rediscovered by New Englanders who turned this into sort of the first Thanksgiving. And it was a woman named Sarah Josepha Hale, who's best known for having written Mary Had a Little Lamb. I'm really bad at ditties. And she kind of launched this campaign to turn Thanksgiving into a national holiday. So there is a kind of whole history to Thanksgiving itself, and it takes a very long time. Lincoln declares the first national Thanksgiving, and then Southerners kind of resist that. And it, you know, slowly catches on, and then over time also becomes this sort of commercial and football holiday as well. But what interests me in part is that my mother helps immigrants prepare for their citizenship test. It's about to change, but if you look at the citizenship test we've been using for years, I think, help me, Mom, there's four questions on there about the pilgrims. And when I went through it, there isn't a single other question about America before 1776. It's as if that's the only unit you need to know. The pilgrims came on the Mayflower. They had Thanksgiving. I've forgotten what the other two questions are. So we really have clung to that story.
But Thanksgiving is based on the footnote.
It's based on a little more than a footnote, but not much more.
Thank you.
I've been intrigued by the way that in the Capitol, in the Rotunda and elsewhere, the recognition, if you will, of the Spanish conquistadors and the landing of the DeSoto's discovery of the Mississippi, so forth. And I always wondered how that came about. Mm-hmm. What was the political context in which there was this attempt to connect our history or the history of the United States with the Spanish, who represented, as you say, a wholly different culture?
Mm-hmm. Right. No, there have been periods where we have recognized the Spanish. It's kind of gone in these cycles. And there was a big cycle in the 1930s and 40s when it was the 400th anniversary of the Coronado and DeSoto expeditions. There were all kinds of ceremonies and monuments and a lot of the Depression era, you know, wall murals and you see all through the Southwest.
But this was in the 1830s.
This is, I think the best explanation of that was that it was the era of manifest destiny. And this was kind of part of that story of Europeans bringing civilization and Christianity to the savages. I think that's what that's about. What interests me about that, because that's all really anyone remembers about DeSoto, is that he discovered the Mississippi, is that even the characters we think we know a bit about, a lot of the books about people most of us have never heard of, but it's also about characters we think we know about, like Columbus and DeSoto and others, that most of what we know about them is myth and misconception. DeSoto, of course, didn't discover the Mississippi. Natives had known about it forever, but also other Spaniards had found it before. But what he did do was much more significant. He had a really 3,000-mile death march across the South that did more damage than Katrina and Sherman's march combined. So we really should remember him, but not for the reasons that they did in the 1830s and 40s with that fabulous mural. But I talk about that mural in the book and sort of pull it apart.
You put it in its context.
Yeah, I try to do that. But it is a wonderful, it is, again, part of the mythology, along with the other murals there, John Smith and Pocahontas. Another myth, but anyway, that's a long story.
Hi.
I don't recognize you.
Mr. Horwitz, if I may. Hey, Tony, I just was interested if you could do a little stitch together. The Confederates in the Attic crowd, you know, clearly that was an odd lot of interesting people that you journey with, folks feeling period rush. And you also have a crowd here, too. And I wonder the compare and contrast. What links these groups? What's similar? What's different of the two gangs you run with here? And maybe what's one person here? I think we know about Confederates, but what's one person here that you felt like you learned the most from in terms of the long kind of human journey?
Good grief. this is my former roommate in journalism school, so he's good at asking probing questions. Yeah, he's decided to stick me here. I don't I don't actually think there's huge overlap between sort of Civil War remembrance and remembrance of this era, to be frank. This tends to be regional in a different way. In the Southwest, obviously, they're very aware of the Spanish history. In the Northeast, it's about the Pilgrims. In Virginia, Jamestown. So it really depends where you are. And it often has to do with an ethnic or a linguistic connection. It's kind of, you know, this land is my land. We were here first. That's what I came away with from talking to the people who do remember this era and want to honor it. And whether it's Native Americans or any number of people who want to say essentially, we're the first Americans. So it's a little bit balkanized, but it's different from the Confederate story, I would say. Now, what was the second? A figure from the present or the past that really present? I don't know. I met a lot of interesting characters. I'm trying to think of one who stands out. You know, I was most intrigued by my conversation with Indians around the country rather than choosing one person, of people who were really almost extinguished by what happened in the 16th century and recognized this as a significant part of their history while other Americans tend to forget it, and they haven't. And particularly actually in Virginia, where I write about how Indians went through a sort of second period of what was really statistical genocide. And I guess I was most interested in talking to them and how they make sense of that, and also now that we're suddenly in this era where acknowledging your Indian heritage is kind of a plus, having gone through most of their lives, the older people, hiding this or, you know, running away from it in some way, and suddenly, you know, you're supposed to embrace it. So I would say my conversations with Native Americans in New Mexico, Newfoundland, Virginia, Florida, and elsewhere were the ones that stuck with me the most. So I'm not going to answer your question, Serial. I think I'm getting the cut sign. So happy to talk to you individually, but thanks very much.
Thanks for joining us on Book Tour. For more readings like this one, please visit npr.org/booktour.